coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome to another episode of Worth Doing Badly from Ethan Stoppenhagen, David Weber, and me, Jamie Krieger. On this episode, we will look at the lessons for the fourth Sunday of Easter, and they are Acts 2 verses 42 to 47, Psalm 23, 1 Peter 2 verses 19 to 25, and John 10 verses 1 to 10. We begin, as always, with David Weber.
I've been impressed by how a creed stakes a truth claim. An interesting creed stakes a claim whose truthfulness is not obvious. And so obviously the creed I'm speaking of is the Apostles or Nicene Creed. The Christian creed stakes the claim that Christ's descent into hell was part of the whole movement of salvation, and that descent halted the fall of man and turned it around. It reversed it. That in hell, Christ set the rock bottom place where the fall can go no further. And from that time on, from his descent into hell onward, the reversal means that the whole cosmos has been turned or is being turned upright. We consider upright a kind of a moral term, but it's actually the reversing of the fall. It's turning us off our heads and making the whole cosmos upright. And this reversal, as the creed both claims and proclaims, was confirmed by Christ's resurrection and his ascension, so that from then on, time moves towards a joyful consummation and not, as it seems, towards a chaotic catastrophe. So this text expands on the creed's claim by proclaiming that our ascent is towards the Greek word that's translated usually abundance. I like the translation that it's an over-the-top fulfillment. That's what Christ came to bring, an over-the-top fulfillment of our desire for life. And this desire for Christ's abundant life promises to generate a holy dissatisfaction with this world, with desires that are focused on this world, that the more we spend our time with Christ, the more increasingly we see the worldly desires as tawdry and short-sighted and lacking imagination. So when Christ promises to be our good shepherd, he promises to lead us through this life of disappointed desire to the green pastures that eternally fulfill our desire for life. In order to contrast this promised life, this excessive fulfillment of our desire for life, this gift, with our present reality that as our good shepherd Jesus is leading us through, the contrast is between this over-the-top fulfillment and with a scarcity that has us so scared that we think our desires might go begging, and so we're tempted to criminally rob and steal life whenever and wherever we can. We imagine wrongly that goodness is in short supply, so we beg, borrow, and buy and steal in order to accumulate stuff, with the wrong imagination that more stuff means more life. So when Jesus promises to be our good shepherd, he liberates us from this mad pursuit by proclaiming that he came to give the abundant life. Life is from top to bottom a gift. And that gift, he promises to lead us to the over the top abundance. And one key stage in this pilgrimage is learning to ignore the fear of scarcity, in seeing that fear is cast by the shadow of death, and that Christ's resurrection has overcome that death. And so it's the shadow is an illusion. It is not the truth about our lives. So I find this passage a bit funny because Jesus, after Jesus explained that he is the good shepherd, John records that the disciples did not understand this. Jesus as the good shepherd has inspired beautiful and some hideous hymns and poems and art. And so I wonder what it was that the disciples didn't understand about this metaphor of the good shepherd. Now, what I find funny is that John records that when the disciples expressed their misunderstanding, Jesus changed the metaphor and proclaimed that he is the door, which is an image that has not, to my knowledge, inspired much beautiful or hideous hymns, poems, and art. It's kind of like the children's riddle. When is a door not a door? When it's ajar. Here, when is a door not a door? It's when the door is the good shepherd. And it seems like Jesus calling himself first the good shepherd and then the door hit home with the disciples. And together, these two metaphors help us understand why Jesus can claim and proclaim himself as the satisfaction of all our desires, and especially our eternal desire, our insatiable desire for life. So in time, the disciples would understand their dependence and desire for the good shepherd. And that would happen by living in a world of thieving deception. They would recognize their dependence and desire for the trustworthy voice of Christ's authority. Recognizing how often deceptive thieving voices repeatedly led them to dead ends of disappointed promises, they would come to recognize, as we come to recognize in the same way, that desiring the eternal and fulfilling the fulfillment of our desires requires an exit. If our desires are ever going to be met, we need an exit. We need to make an exodus out of this scarcity into abundance. So Jesus has to function as both the good shepherd and the door. Now, presently, I don't know what to think of all of the wringing hands commentary on chatbots and AI. But I do know it's fueling our fear of fakes and forgeries. But this passage makes it clear, fakes and forgeries have always been here. The fear of being fooled is not new. It is just the latest evidence of showing our need for a trustworthy voice of the Good Shepherd who teaches us what truth is and leads us, that truth that draws us and leads us through the door into life. And so, you know, people ask, how is the church going to respond? Well, the way the church always responds to any version of thieves robbing life from people by deception is to continually claim and proclaim the truth of the creed and showing in our lives why this truth is trustworthy and why the promise of Christ as our good shepherd is exactly what we need for the present and has always been what we need.
What do we do when people don't buy it? When they're kind of like the disciples and this whole idea of a good shepherd who is going to, on whom they should depend and who's going to fulfill their desires. How do we lead people to see that it's something true and good instead of just another attempt from the world to suck you in?
I think there's two things that we can be confident of. The first one is that people are going to be disappointed. And the disappointment is going to be catastrophic. It's going to shake the very foundations. It's going to, and I see that now. I just see people wanting, almost desiring bad news to confirm the fact that they have that they live in a fearful world. For some reason, that's satisfying or whatever. So we know already, as Jesus said, that apart from being able to trust him, there are thieves and robbers out there, and everyone is going to be, either become a thief or robber, or they're going to be victimized by that. And you can extend that metaphor. So I don't think we do anything, Ethan. I just think that we have the confidence that this is going to happen. And we have the confidence because we have seen it in our own lives of falling for deceptions and knowing, having experienced those deceptions as crushing as they are. And the corollary, the second thing we can be confident of, it, after we recognize we don't have to do anything, is not to ruin opportunities to be there when the disappointment has taken hold, in order to be the presence of Christ as the trustworthy good shepherd. And this is where I have horrible memories of thinking that the present argument was so important to win, and in doing that, I cut off opportunity to keep the conversation going, rather than dealing with the other person in confidence that they need this, that they need Christ in their life, and just letting things go for to be able to talk another day. Trying to win the battle just doesn't make sense. And that's a long answer, but it's an answer, as I said, as a confession. I just wish in my life I had not done certain things that cut off the conversation. But going back to it, I think that the psalm does give us kind of an answer to this, is that if we're really confident that Jesus has what Christians desire, but what human beings desire. If the Christian faith is Catholic, small c, universal, that for all people everywhere and for all time, then to have that confidence is to say that events in this life will eventually show that what we do need is what Christ offers us in being the good shepherd. And I think one of the ways that this is seen is how many times people who've had no truck with the church at all, who have come in desperate and especially at a time of death, they know Psalm 23. They recognize that there's something profoundly comforting in saying, "The Lord is my shepherd," which is, I find hilarious. They don't want Jesus as the good shepherd, but they want to say, "The Lord is my shepherd." And they're saying the right exact same thing, except Psalm 23 says it in a beautiful poem. And I think in this time, or at least maybe it's just indicative of what I want, the passage that says, "I shall not want," is so inviting. It's so attractive to me. And so I wonder, what is it that puts an end to want? Well, we stop wanting once we lose our appetite. But the loss of appetite is not a sign of health. It's a sign of sickness. Or the loss of appetite, you're not hungry after you eat a fine meal, so it doesn't need to be a sign of sickness. It can be a sign of satisfaction. Or another way of not wanting is to that kind of refusal to let our appetites or to lose our appetites for something superior, some coming satisfaction, by filling ourselves with an inferior but immediate gratification. I mean, one of my European friends oftentimes laugh at the American restaurant experience, where you go to this restaurant because the food is supposed to be so good, and the first things that you get is a big plate of bread, and the bread is endless, so that you ruin your hunger for the thing that the restaurant is known for by eating this bread beforehand. And so it's something like that not wanting is not wanting to lose our appetite for the thing which is superior, which Christ obviously says we have this eternal desire for life that can only be satisfied with eternal life. So why ruin that appetite by thinking that tawdry, superficial life here can satisfy it? So it's, again, I apologize beforehand, but I think this is most evident in the nearly miraculous union in the Western Christian tradition, the union of sex as a sign of trust and faithfulness. Once that union was taken for granted, it's no longer there. That people who trusted that sex should be in marriage because it was an expression, it was a consummation of a relationship of trust and faithfulness, and that trust and faithfulness satisfied a deep desire. And so they would say, not out of desperate moral obligation, but out of desire, we will wait for marriage. That's what it means not to want, I think, in this passage. And what's sad is the cultural thieves have robbed the world of this ideal, leaving in its wake a sadness and loneliness that, at least in the United States, we have never seen before. So the Good Shepherd, with Christ as our Good Shepherd, promising to satisfy our wants with the holy desire for better things that can only be satisfied in eternity, that Christ shows us that our satisfaction is not in this world. This world, because every aspect of this world is enshrouded by the shadow of death. And so having this holy desire for wholeness, the door becomes our greatest desire. That's a weird thing to say, but that is what we most desire. We want passage out of this. Not that this is terrible, not that life that God hasn't in fact blessed us richly in this life, but it still comes down to it that the door becomes our greatest desire. Later on, it'll be the office of the keys will be given to the church to open this door. Passage from this disappointing life to abundance is the object of our desire. So this desire door to satisfaction means that we cultivate an insatiable appetite for life. And our insatiable appetite for a life that cannot be satisfied here isn't an addiction, because it will in fact be satisfied. We no longer are required to steal and rob good things, because we are freed by having a good shepherd. And as for our desires for goodness and mercy, we get goodness and mercy in this life, but it follows us. It follows us. It surprises us. It comes from behind, and it gives us a passing taste of the goodness that will be permanently fulfilled when the good shepherd leads us through the door. That is the goodness that satisfies us, and that satisfaction is expressed in the phrase, "We shall not want."
I can't help but make the connection, you know, with the door and this idea of movement, you know, how he's leading us down paths as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And you previously mentioning the, you know, the way out, how we're seeking an exodus. So do you think there's a way to tie together this language of want and desires with the language of movement?
My love of pilgrimage is reading about them and wondering how this became such an important practice, the idea that moving from one place to the next, of having a desired destination, you know, and all these people who speak gloriously of the pilgrimages across the world or the Appalachian Trail, all are getting at that movement and passage and getting to where you desire to be is probably the most important way of understanding that desires are not immediately gratified. Real desires aren't afraid of the word discipline, aren't afraid of the word the word waiting. And this is why I love the imagery of the robber and the thief. That's what's happened in our culture, that beautiful things have been stolen and treated as if they are obligations and ugly. And it's in one sense I'm saddened by it, but in another sense that is, I think the conditions are very ripe for people to once again at least appreciate, if not actually embark on, this pilgrimage, this movement towards the real fulfillment of desires. And I had an interesting conversation with someone who wasn't raised in the church at all, and he knows I'm a pastor, and he's a younger person. And he said, I don't really want to go to church, but he said, the one thing that is missing from my life are all of the metaphors that you are allowed to use in talking about, you know, what you aspire for, desire. And I said, well, those metaphors aren't just metaphors. They're actually, I expect them to be really fulfilled. You know, heaven isn't just a metaphor. It's an actual destination. But he recognized, and he was interested in all the, you know, the pilgrimage preparation that we made. But he recognizes that to be able to think of your life as going beyond your life is such a huge gift. I mean, it's a gift of hope. And we see this in the book of Acts. For most people, this will not seem attractive, I don't think. But in the book of Acts, they overcame an era of confusion and mistrust by coming together and breaking bread and praying together. They were criminalized, the Christian church already. They recognized in being followers of Christ, they were criminals, and criminals would have all of their goods confiscated. So there is this sense that they already knew that they were in for a rougher time, and they met that with joyful breaking of bread and prayers. They were enjoying their moment that they had together. They were recognizing that Christ's promise of goodness and mercy following them would in fact be true that to all the followers of Jesus. And so the passage says, recognizing their situation, they sold their possessions and belongings, and they distributed them, the proceeds, to all who had need. That's, I think, one of the key ways that the church shows that it is living by trusting the goodness and the mercy that the Good Shepherd promised to give, is that there is a profligacy, there is an excessiveness, an over-the-topness in desiring to give away. If life is a gift, then we experience that gift not only in receiving, but also and mainly in giving. And in this case, this has not been the standard of the church. This has not been how the church, and I don't think the church actually is expected to. These were extraordinary conditions, and yet we should be inspired by the beauty of that. When conditions lead to itself, to divest yourself and be able to just share freely, knowing that the uncertainty of the future means that you are totally dependent upon the care of the Good Shepherd. And, you know, enjoying the care of the Good Shepherd. They didn't fear. They had lots to fear, but they didn't fear. They rather experienced that we talked about earlier of not wanting, or if they had a want, it was a want to share. And once free of the worry of their wants, they turned their attention to caring for those in need. I think that is going to be maybe we don't do anything individually, but what we do is recognize that the world makes victims daily and makes a lot of victims. There is never a shortage of victims for Christian compassion to direct the attention. And this goodness and mercy that follows us meant that the Lord added to their number day by day of those who were being saved. And of course, that is connected to the witness that the early church gave in their trust in Christ's promises. Now, as if we don't have enough to talk about, and again, I have to remind myself that these passages are helpful, but they don't need to be mentioned in every sermon or even in any sermon. They are, in a sense, the preacher has a special gift of these four passages, working with them and adding unstated depth to the sermon. And so, but this is an abundance of material here. And with Peter, telling us to be mindful of God, that we can have, as Paul says, we can have the mind of Christ. This is extraordinary. We confess to be sinners. We confess to be selfish and distracted. And yet there is still this promise that we can think like God, that there is that God is at work in us. And so, to think like God means to be trusting in the goodness of the Good Shepherd, even when it's not visible, or especially when it's not visible. The Psalm says this goodness and mercy follows us. We don't have eyes in the back of our heads. We can't see how it's going to happen. It is going to be a surprise. And oftentimes it's a surprise given by people we don't expect. So, and quite frankly, the Psalm makes it clear that our sight is obscured by darkness, by the shadow of death, which is everywhere. And so in this darkness, Peter says, be mindful of God. And thinking like God, we practice the art of interpretation. And when we see suffering and sorrow, we recognize that because we are pilgrims, because we are on the path of life, because no door we meet will not be opened, because Christ is the door. He is not just the one who opens the door. He is the door itself. That all suffering and sorrow are merely stages that we are passing through on our way to the kind of life that we desire. And so in these passages, it encourages us to fervently pray to the Lord that God put us not to the test. This is true. We don't want the test, but if it should happen, if sorrow and suffering be our lot, then we pray that God would deliver us from evil, and that in that deliverance from evil, in that Christ would show us again and again that his words are trustworthy, and they will carry us to this over-the-top satisfaction of our desires.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Go to the App Store or Google Play and get the one that is right for you for free. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other programs on our schedule, write me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. David and I will be back next week at this same time. Stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.